Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Decentralizing AI with myself, Jesse, and Dustin. And we have a special guest today, Max. We're really happy to have him on the show.
Hello.
Welcome.
Yeah. Maybe you can introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're interested in.
Oh, God. Well, if you've watched another show in this spot, I sit in the same spot on Fridays, the Presidio Bitcoin Jam. So you guys have probably, if you've listened to that, heard me chat about some Bitcoin things, some AI things, which I'm interested in, all of the above. But honestly, the context for this show that I'm much more interested in is, you know, for some time we've kind of had AI and I'd say more avant out there discussions around AI in the hallways. We've been talking about doing a trialogue in the sort of tradition of Terence McKenna, and I forget the other guy's name is Ralph.
There's Rupert Sheldrake.
Rupert Sheldrake. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's the mathematician guy.
Ralph something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Apologies to him.
Yes. Sorry, Sam. They're all interesting.
Great. Yeah.
I was thinking, how badass would it be to kind of like pick up the torch where those guys left off with two of the smartest and most, philosophically inclined people I know. And so, yeah, that's why I'm here to help you guys on the pod and to get the trilogues back.
Love it.
I'm so excited to have you here, Max. You're kind of in the special place for me because you are actually, I'm going to profess my love for you. No, I'm just kidding.
All good.
Good friends.
Love you too.
No. You know, I flew out to do a hackathon here about a year ago now. Mm-hmm. And that was just an incredible experience and was looking into like starting a company. And you just kind of were one of the voices that helped me pull the trigger on that decision and come out. And it's just like an incredible space. Presidio Bitcoin is a wonderful community. And it's so cool to, finally do like a proper show.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So where should we embark? There's so much to talk about. Anybody have something in particular they want to get us started with?
I actually do. So there's a lot of topics that we could jump into, I'm sure we will, and hopefully this is the first of many trilogues. But the topic that I'd like to start with is something that we've all discussed, and Jesse, I believe you have some very interesting theories around, which is the topic of language itself.
Yes.
And so I'm interested in this from at least two perspectives. The first perspective is Terence McKenna, who I think is one of the most underrated philosophers of the last century, and someone that I think we all have, you know, varying degrees of familiarity with and certainly appreciation for. You know, once said that the world is made of language. Mm-hmm. And I think you could take that in many ways, literally, figuratively. The second area that I want to bring into this is the idea that obviously the rage in AI right now, though certainly not all of AI, is large language models.
Right.
And so I think these two sort of threads converge in it very nicely. So maybe I'd love to start by posing the question of what the hell is language? Is the world in fact made of it? And what implications does that have for how far LLMs can actually go?
Yeah. I have so much to say about this.
It's a big
I'm
topic.
Excited. I know exactly. Yeah. This is the easy one, guys.
Yeah. Start easy. Yeah.
But I think one place to start is maybe contrasting a few different theories of language. Because I think the more conventional theory, the more modern theory of language is kind of that language is secondary. Mm-hmm. Like when you think about, you know, did language exist before any living things,
mm-hmm.
you know, like at the Big Bang or the first 100 years of the universe, was there language? And I think, you know, most people would say no. You know, language is something that came into being with humans, you know, or maybe primitive forms of language with animals. And it is what is primary. This is kind of the perspective of scientific materialism. What is primary is what is material, what is quantifiable, what is measurable.
Mm-hmm.
That is what is most real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, consciousness is like an epiphenomenon, maybe doesn't even exist. You know, language is just language.
We have a lot to say on that one too.
Yeah.
And language is just symbolic.
Mm-hmm.
It's arbitrary symbols that we attach to things.
Mm-hmm.
The other theory of language that you see a lot in mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, and RK Logos in the beginning was the word.
Mm-hmm.
That language was the first thing mm-hmm. that came into being, mm-hmm. and that everything has a linguistic being, even before humans, mm-hmm. even before consciousness, that the most fundamental nature of everything is language. Mm-hmm. And what is meant there by language is not just symbolic representation, but expressivity, mm-hmm. communicativity. Mm-hmm.
Would you say meaning?
And meaning, yeah. And I think what's interesting there is it might kind of help explain the surprising effectiveness of the large language model. Because mm-hmm. it should just be like a stochastic parrot. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, people, I've talked to people who've said it's just a search engine, right? It's just a way of querying what's in its data. Like, how is it that just predicting the next word mm-hmm. is able to have such incredible effectiveness? And just recently, there was this unsolved math problem, this, yeah. you know, Erdos or Erdos problem, mm-hmm. and that the LLM solved. Like, I think that just was announced yesterday.
Yesterday, yeah. It's a big deal.
And so it gets harder and harder to claim that it's just a search engine because that math, that solution was not in the data set. Mm-hmm. Or to say, you know, all the language model can do is just kind of recombine what's already there. It being able to discover something that's genuinely new kind of suggests that there's more to language, that language is able to tap into everything. That if you have a language machine, mm-hmm. then it can have this relationship with being itself. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, and this also comes up in Heidegger. Mm-hmm. So for Heidegger, he's saying there's like the scientific materialistic model, but he says what's more fundamental to that, like the fact that we can only have abstract symbolic representation or science or measurement because there's something more fundamental about human beings, that they have this relationship to things through language mm-hmm. where they're able to disclose themselves and unconceal themselves through language itself. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is actually very similar to like this debate about world models versus language models. Because mm-hmm. in some ways, the world model is the representation of things as things in the world, objects in the world. Mm-hmm. And language models is about language itself. And so from a scientific materialistic basis, it might seem, well, the world model is more fundamental,
right?
And language is secondary. Mm-hmm. But what we're seeing, at least currently, is like the LLM is having this incredible effectiveness without even having any, you know, without needing the formal world model. Maybe there's like an implied world model or something like that.
I mean, they definitely have some world model information within them. I mean, if you can ask it, you know, if I go outside tomorrow in the rain and I'm walking with my umbrella, will I get wet? Or you can ask it about future states and it can synthesize information to tell you like what that next state may be. If you can give a state and an action and predict a next state, it's a world model in my book. Like you can use that to project future world states.
Yeah.
The thing is really that in a lot of ways, a lot of times when you want to do planning about the future, the reason that's really valuable is for all the guarantees you get on those plans. Like you can get kind of proofs that certain states won't be reached that are dangerous, and certain states you want to reach, it is possible to even reach them. And for that, you often need like certain kinds of structure to hold. And you just oftentimes don't have that structure with large language models, but that doesn't mean that they have zero world transition information within them. So I thought like, and I think a lot of times when they are useful is often because they have some, I've been saying shallow, maybe I should be saying like less structured, but because I think they can actually have a lot of world model information inside them, but they're not traditionally like, and they're not often like used in the way a lot of times world models are used.
Well, one thing I think might be useful is even to consider this idea that I've been thinking about, which is, are there, you know, almost two or maybe multiple classes of language? And, you know, in the examples that you guys are given, so for example, in this, what you're saying, you know, the case where you can extrapolate from language about, okay, I'm going to get wet if I go outside in the rain, you know, it's almost asking this question of like, okay, well, there's the territory and then there's the map. And like, in this case, you're saying, well, language is the map of the territory, and there's enough implicit information in a more detailed map to be able to deduce things about, certainly deeper in the map and probably about the world that it maps onto. Then there's another fundamental question of like, but can that representation of the thing ever be the entire thing? And are those almost two kinds of languages? Similarly, Jesse, you bring up this idea that, you know, as large language models push further, you are seeing new creative breakthroughs, you know, but from potentially combinations of old things. And again, I almost wonder if there's two kinds of creativity here. And I feel like, again, our language is almost too primitive to like flesh out these two different threads, because there's no question in my mind that like, if you feed, and I'm sure people will do this, but if you feed like all of Wikipedia to the LLM and say, okay, take this, you know, whatever page on, I don't know, like some obscure like African art form and this page on some mathematical model, and you say, mash these two things up and find some novel piece of information. Like, I think it's going to be able to do that to infinity. I think there's infinite new information it can find. But that is also potentially still, or maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but I think it's an open debate or question of, is that different from the kinds of knowledge that seem to come from like a spark or intuition, or potentially from outside of all of the existing combinatorial new information that we can find? And this gets me back to something that, you know, you and I have chatted a bit about, and Dustin, you as well, which is this idea of language as logos, and if that's different from language as descriptor. Because if you look, you know, in sort of the great sort of religions of the world, they all say in the Bible, in the beginning was the word. You know, it wasn't was the thing, it was the word. In Hinduism, what's the first thing? It's a sound that speaks things into existence. In the case of Terence, you know, in some of his more colorful trips, which may or may not have been assisted by DMT, he's out there talking to machine-shifting elves who are speaking objects into existence. So, I guess, I mean, I'll throw all that out to you guys, but maybe try and synthesize this by, you know, are there two forms of language? Is logos different than description? And are there different kinds of creativity that can come from each?
Yeah, I mean, I think the word logos itself is interesting because it means logic, it means ratio, it means language, and it means word, all as a single concept that's fused together. And it is not just a language or an example of language, it is somehow the essence of language as like a transcendental object.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that is, now, like when you look at I saw an example where they had LLMs represented geometrically,
mm-hmm.
as like a really complex visualization of its geometry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the Greeks, geometry was everything.
Right.
Like the Euclid and the Platonic solids, like the idea of sacred geometry,
mm-hmm.
that there could be within a geometry that it contains everything.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or another example, like in Jewish mysticism, the Torah is thought to contain everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that by studying it, all wisdom, all knowledge, everything that can be understood is somehow already in it.
Mm.
And even in a single letter, or even in the stroke of a single letter, that stroke contains everything.
Like a fractal.
You know what's amazing about this is, you know, I guess just to continue, would you say that to when they say contain here, that maybe they're also meaning could be interpreted from?
Yes, very much.
Because
so.
If that is the case, I was obsessed with this research problem for a couple of years on constructing world models, basically like symbolic relational world models, kind of like very classic AI, the way AI planners, like I was writing these in grad school to like control robots and video game characters and other things. And, you know, these go way back like decades in AI. And a lot of people would consider like good old fashioned AI, but you can, you can like, it's like an ecology. You can encode, you know, symbols and relations, but the whole point is that it's relational. And, you know, as a grad student writing these by hand, you know, you really get a sense of like, first of all, how much work it is to write anything that's useful. It needs a certain level of complexity and it can be brittle, because when you don't get it quite right or you want to do something new, you might have to like change the whole thing. Kind of like when you write software, you pick an abstract, like the architecture, and then you need to like refactor. It's like every time you refactor, that's like you're creating like a new relational structure. Anyway, all of this to say is that I got really obsessed with the problem of how you could construct these from pure interactions with an environment, like zero human data. Like literally, could you just get some agent acting in any way? Just literally, it could even be taking random actions in an environment. And that's all you get. You just get these state action trajectories, right? Like kind of very raw data. It could be like motor movements and images, whatever. Could you construct just from that, like these symbolic relational world models? And there's some incredible researchers that have done that. There's like a paper that was published like 5 years ago now. And what they showed is like you can build the pipeline to produce these. But here's what gets it. Okay, there's an infinite number of abstract relational world models. So there's basically like an infinite number of ways of like interpretations from something, right? And but for that to be useful, you're often looking for like the smallest one, or you almost always you're looking for like the smallest one or the one that like has like less noise compared to like the raw structure. But if you had this, then what this means is like you could have a system, you could have like a robot explore an environment, and it is creating an ontology, an understanding of the world, like concepts of the world that might be so alien to what a human would ever consider. Like we have cups and glasses and we make arbitrary distinctions on like words and everything. So, but the thing is, what's awesome is like we mostly, I mean, I feel like most people live at this conceptual level.
Yeah.
Like you think about objects and these, it's all concepts in your head. You're not thinking about these low level, you know, atomic or like, you know, physics level or all these things. And so this is all to say that so the reason we don't have this AI today is like they laid out the pipeline. It's fascinating. You have multiple combinatorial explosions. Like it is so interesting. And that's on toy domains, like simple paradigmatic think Towers of Hanoi kind of domains, like very simple, right? And there's like such a combinatorial explosion, which just means that like it's so complex that like you need to inject all this stuff. Anyway, long story short, this just reminds me that like I could see that mapping onto what you just said about like the Torah containing everything, because the space of interpretation for anything might be infinite.
Right. And so in that way, even if the LLM is just a search engine,
right,
if the thing is it's searching is a transcendental object that contains everything, and if somehow that's what it's backing into with its training data, like if you give it everything that's ever been written and it's finding the structure there, that structure might be transcendental. Like that structure might be embedded into all language and all thought. And so it was derived from a specific set of data,
right?
But the thing that's finding in common applies to all data,
right?
And if that's what it is searching, then it can find everything in it.
You need the right prompt, though. Maybe.
Well, right. And that's what Jess has been doing, right?
Or, I mean, that shows that the power to name things is the most important AI skill. Or the power to ask the right question, because everything is already contained in the latent space, but you have to conjure it out. You have to name it. You have to speak it, like the machine elves.
You have to spell it.
Well, just one thing on that, though. I think it's more that it's not that it's necessarily fully in the weights themselves. Like there is a single forward pass you could do over, and if that lights up certain weights in the network, you would get what you're looking for. I think instead it might be better to think of it as a seed. And when you grow the seed like through a reasoning trace or a run, but you want to maybe like grow it many, many times, but the space that is produced from running it and reasoning with it, that is where it exists.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Well, okay. So, I mean, I think there's a lot to explore here. There's so much.
Everything.
I know, yeah, literally. Everything. And I think two things. One, Jesse, maybe it'd be helpful if you explain what you mean by transcendental object. Because I know maybe some listeners will be like, what the hell is that? I mean, I'm assuming you're getting to
an infinity stone.
Well, I'm kidding. These ideas of sort of I don't know Platonic DNA of the universe or whatever. But one thing I'd like to go further on is this idea that say that this new structure that we found, this new implicit order that LLMs have discovered, or yeah, like you know, it's almost like it was there, but we needed the right machine to be able to see it, just like. You know, you couldn't see subatomic particles before you had the right microscope or, you know, whatever it was. Do you think, though, when you say that the most important thing is being able to name stuff, like I 100% buy that that's true in the world of humans dealing with other humans or manipulating the reality around us. At the same time, do you think that, are you suggesting that implicit order goes even further? And so for one very concrete example, I could totally believe that implicit order could apply to the actual biological life forms because DNA is just four letters and those are literally just sequences of information. So I could buy that implicit order could expand into that. What do you think about expanding even further though? Like literally into like there are, you know, whatever, even though it's not actually a physical object, from our perception, it's a physical object. Are you suggesting that implicit order in language extends into the construction and navigation of the real world beyond the sort of human-driven biological manipulation of it on top?
Yeah, well, if language is the essence of all things, if language was created before everything else, then language isn't just a matter of representing something. It's like the source code, where if you can tap into the source code, you can manipulate things at a more fundamental level. So like that's the whole idea of magic, right? If you say, you know, abracadabra, you say the magic word.
Right.
It's not word as in terms of discursive logic and reasoning. It's a word as power, which also relates to Tantra. That like in Tantra, there was the Shiva-based tradition that preceded Tantra, where the path to enlightenment was through contemplation, removal from the world, and abstract discursive reasoning, conceptualization about the nature of all things. The insight in Tantra was that in the Kali Yuga, there's this idea in Hinduism...
which we're in right now.
of these yugas, of these big periods of these big epochs, that there's like kind of a golden age where everybody's like connected to the truth and all the political systems are like governed by, you know, it's like you think of like the King Arthur world and Camelot, like everything's like as you would think they should be.
It's on a Bitcoin standard.
Right, exactly. and the citadels, and, you know. And then there's like our world, the fallen world.
The fourth turning.
You know, the world, you know, where we're banished from the garden. Yeah. We ate the apple everything seems broken. Everything seems inverted. Everything is a struggle. Everything, the political systems don't work correctly, you know. So in Hinduism, there's that idea that there's this cyclical process, maybe kind of like the fourth turning or something, but in a more kind of like cosmic level.
Yeah.
And so the insight in Tantra was that in the Kali Yuga, the discursive reasoning and just kind of like transcending everything doesn't work. And you have to use words as words of power. So that's like the idea of a mantra isn't like a logical argument. It's like a magic word that changes the nature of things. And, you know, so the idea is like, you know, a monk meditating in the cave in the Himalayas can, through meditation and through mantra and through tapping into these hidden esoteric mystical levels of reality, can be having a more profound impact on the political dynamics of planet Earth than the president.
I love that. Yeah.
And when you think about the nature of power, power likes to hide. because that's where it can operate unimpeded, right? Or like from the Art of War, Sun Tzu, all warfare is by deception. You know, think about how intelligence agencies operate or secret societies. The most powerful things are the most hidden things, the most secret things, not what you see on the surface.
Yeah.
If you see it on the surface, if it's in the news, that's probably a sideshow.
Yeah.
It's the things that nobody's seeing or paying attention to that have the real influence, the real power.
And you know, the best place for a secret to hide is in plain sight.
Absolutely. Yeah. So
there's a lot there. I just want to maybe unpack one piece because it's absolutely fascinating, everything you're saying. When you say language, and we're talking about these large language models and how it seems like you're like, at least the sense I'm getting is that they might be this like incredible unlock of something we've never been able to unlock before. But that being said, when you say language, I think the word language might even be confusing here because it sounds like you're not talking about like English, like the letters of English and the words of English necessarily.
Right.
Can you just elaborate on that a little? Or
yeah, I mean, this actually relates to an essay I was rereading recently by Walter Benjamin called On the Language of Man and Language as Such. And in this essay, he argues that everything has a language, everything has a linguistic being. So like a cup has a language, a mountain has a language, a painting has a language. What he means by that is that it communicates something. Language is expressive. It communicates something about what it is. So when we think about just things in the world, we're like, they're not like, we're interpreting it and that's where it comes from. So it's hard to think like, oh, the cup is trying to communicate something to us. Like the cup is just an inanimate object. But think about like a painting of a cup. What is that painting communicating, right? Well, there's an artist that has an intention, but, or what about just a photograph of a cup?
Right.
Like once you put a frame on something,
right,
you don't change anything about it. You just put a frame on it. Suddenly it's communicating something. Suddenly if it's in a museum, somebody can tell you this is what it means.
Right.
This is what it's saying. Or another example of that is in dreams, right? Everything in the dream is not just the cup, but the cup is communicating something about your psyche. You know, like your teeth fall out and that means you're, you know, afraid of something, or like all the Freudian ways of communicating all the things in the dream. Each object is almost like a linguistic entity that is communicating something.
Right.
Well, if we're in a cosmic dream, then everything in waking consciousness is also communicating something. The cup isn't just communicating that it's a cup.
Right.
It's communicating that there's order and there's water and there's fluid and there's life and
neg entropy right here.
You know, there's all this meaning that we can unpack from the fact that there is a cup. Right. And so that the cup has a language, you know, or also like an example of this is like feng shui, right? You go into a room and it feels a certain way. You know, you go into someone's house and it's like, you know, oftentimes my house is really messy and disorganized. That's communicating something about my psyche, you know, or you go into a room and everything's well placed and everything is cared for. Everything is infused with, you know, with love or attention, and you feel that, you experience that.
Right.
So there is nothing in the world that does not have language from that perspective. Everything is participating language. Everything is communicating something.
Is it because it's all relative? Like everything is related to one another? Like there's nothing that really exists independently?
I think that is a way of thinking about it, because relation is a form of communication, is a form of information exchange. That's what it means for one thing to be related to something else.
Right. Well, and then I think it gets to the deeper question of who is it communicating to? Which we can have a whole series of podcasts just on that.
Yeah, things just got deep.
Yeah.
Who is the witness? Who is the, you know, who is the dreamer?
Exactly.
Right.
And I think one kind of like concrete way, you know, maybe a little even less abstract that I like to think about this is, you know, if you think about
because you said, okay, maybe it's difficult for someone to conceptualize that the cup is communicating to me. But as soon as, you know, your Duchamp or whatever, and you just like put it in a museum, then all of a sudden it's like, oh, now it's art and it's communicating to me. Right. And it's like, well, what if you just approached all of life as if it were art or a video game? Because probably is. And all of a sudden, you know, there's meaning literally everywhere. And anyways, I think that's a pretty fun way to live.
I mean, that's an amazing thing you just mentioned, because, you know, I see a lot, there's a lot of discussion around like the future and like maybe fear or uncertainty about the future that is, seems at least very common, like on social media and stuff. And there's like a lot of people that are, you know, it's maybe more unpredictable than ever. And what I see is like people asking like the most important thing in this future with AI is having meaning, or like giving people like meaning. But what you just said is like, it's you just adopt that philosophy maybe, and now it all has meaning. Like you just treat everything as this, like, I don't know, like a
novel, video game, whatever you want to call it.
Right. I mean, every experience has something to teach us. Every moment, everything we encounter, you know, I mean, it's a contrast to, I think, the kind of conventional view that nothing has meaning, you know, nihilism. Yeah. Everything is random and purposeless, and, you know, and we're just like this weird blip in a sea of infinite abyss that doesn't mean anything at all.
Which, by the way, how fucking crazy is that? Like, whenever people are like, oh no, like the obvious answer to this is that somehow we just like popped up in the middle of a void, and well, I guess that's probably true too, but there's literally no meaning to this. It's all random. Like, I mean, how does anyone
think,
believe that?
I just, from a systems theory, it just never made sense to me. How is, even as dysfunctional, even all the ways you could argue about how dysfunctional political systems or governments or money or all these things are in the world, it still seems incredibly like cooperative. I don't know, like it just seems like it would just all fall apart and nothing exists, and yet somehow we continue to remain and a lot of these systems like keep working. It just feels like that's not the whole story,
you know. And what's interesting is a lot of people say, you know, at first it seems like, oh, well, it's, you know, to steel man some of the opposite perspective.
Sure.
You know, it's like, oh, well, you just want to believe that everything has meaning and, you know, there's this divine nature reality and it's just a fairy tale. And, you know, that makes you feel better and it helps you cope with the fact that nothing has meaning and all of that, right?
Which sounds like a good enough reason to choose that, if you can choose it.
yeah, but, you know,
Destin's ready to go back in the Matrix.
Dude, sign me up.
it could be a good psychological strategy for coping with our existence. But the thing is, actually, the belief that nothing has meaning is the psychological strategy for coping with the infinite, the mysterium tremendum.
I like that.
It is actually much more frightening and terrifying.
Yes.
To think that we can't die, that everything does have meaning. Like death being the end is comforting because it means it's over. There's nothing else to worry about. There's nothing else to stress about. If it keeps going and if you can't make it stop, like being caught in an infinite prison is way worse than dying. Right?
Yeah.
So infinity is actually much more terrifying than death. And Heidegger talks about this too. Like, you know, a lot of people watching this, for example, might be getting pissed off. You know, people react to this. They say, this is all BS and mystical, whatever. Why is it causing that reaction? Right? Like, why is this scientific materialist person so annoyed by this kind of discourse? It's not just neutral. It provokes an emotion that you want to push back against it, right? So Heidegger talks about how there is this unconscious instinctual flight away from the authentic interpretation of reality because that creates existential terror.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates this desire to level things down. reductionism. Mm-hmm. Everything is just this. Everything is just material, just measurable. Everything else is bunk. Everything else is squishy. Everything else is not rational, hard thinking. That is a psychological protection mechanism to push against the authentic reflection, interpretation of being as it is, without borrowing an interpretation from what he calls the they.
Yeah.
Where, what do they think? They have it figured out. The right. experts have it figured out, right? That is comforting. That helps us. But to become, do the authentic existential analytic, what do I think on my own terms? What do I feel? And that contemplation of things as they are is very terrifying. And in fact, a lot of mystical traditions warn against doing that. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're not prepared for it, you shouldn't actually go there. Like, if you activate your kundalini before you're ready for it, you're going to go crazy. Or like in Judaism, you're not supposed to learn Kabbalah until you're 40 years old. Mm. You know, a lot of the, in New Age mysticism, there aren't any warnings about this. It's like, Oh yeah, activate your chakras and become enlightened and just go for it.
I've heard the same thing. Like, there's certain texts, like famous yoga texts, like from the Vedas and stuff, that the instruction is really that if you have not meditated, if you have not experienced a quiet mind, everything you read will simply stay at the conceptual level.
Yeah.
You won't get the experience of it, you know. And so because of that, you will just, it'll stay as this intellectual, like these intellectual concepts, which is not the point.
Okay, so I think this is extremely important and also ties back into some of the theories of language. So obviously, it's sort of fresh in my mind. You know, you say, Jesse, that sort of staring into the infinity of what we are, you know, can be terrifying, but it doesn't have to be, right? And I think, you know, there's different ways. I mean, one way you could just, again, if you look at it as all a ride, and, you know, I think of one of the most, one of the most insightful lines of all time is just row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. I mean, it's kind of all encapsulated. So that's one way, is just if you're rowing the boat and it goes on forever, so be it. As long as, you know, you don't take it too seriously. That's one approach. But I can't help but thinking, you know, and I'm obviously very interested in Hinduism, the Vedas, and of course, you know, the Bhagavad Gita below it says as it is. But to me, you know, at least in my own life, practically speaking, the most direct way to get to that is actually through sort of the direct teachings of the Buddha, which is in some ways almost applied Hinduism in my mind, which is to say, to go beyond this conceptual level, to go beyond. Because when you're saying, when you think about it, when you're confronting these things, and a lot of these philosophers like Heidegger and you know, Nietzsche and all these people, I think part of the challenge there is they are observing real truths. And even in a lot of the Vedas, I think they're observing real truths. But I question, you know, maybe yes, maybe no, did they actually have an experience of what that means? And I think, again, this gets to a very fundamental difference. What I was kind of trying to drive at with this difference in, you know, the idea of language, it's one thing to comprehend a concept. It's another thing to understand something at the most basal level, whatever that means, like real, true understanding. And I think those are different things. In the case of, you know, what the Buddha taught and like actual Buddhism, I'm saying that without any of like the religious stuff, is this idea of, you know, observing sensations. And when observing sensations, you see that, you know, nothing, it's never a concept that is good or bad. This is critical. What people react to is a physical sensation. And this, I think Freud talked about this as well, sort of like, you know, everyone's either seeking pleasure or running from displeasure, pain. And that's what the Buddha said a long time ago. And the way out of that was, there was a way out, right? This is the noble truths of Buddhism, is suffering exists. Yes, that's true. But there's a way out, which is to, instead of running from it or trying to hide and distract yourself, face it as head on as humanly possible, away and below the level of conceptual, and confront the sensations.
Yeah.
And realize the law of anicca, or, you know, as even Christians say, this too shall pass. Shout out to Anjali, who just told me that this morning. And seeing that, whether it's a good sensation, very, very pleasant, it's going to leave. If it's a really horrible sensation, it too is going to leave. And when you stop, and obviously this is easier said than done, but when you stop
you know, putting so much mental weight and obsession on the good or the bad.
Right.
Yeah, it can be, there's pain there, but then all of a sudden when you don't dwell on it, it just kind of dissolves. It's not a big deal.
What you resist persists.
Yeah. That's a good way of saying it too.
So the thing is that it's me rejecting the existence of that sensation.
Yes.
That causes it to stay longer. The only way is through. That it can be very uncomfortable. There's like a willingness there to like go through it.
Mm-hmm.
We're also very, like, the other thing I'm just excited about this podcast in general is like, I want to communicate, and I think people need to know, like, how incredible humans are. Like, the human brain is incredible. The human body is incredible. Like, dude, everyone's so excited about robots. You have a way better robot right now that you're driving, like, 24/7. Like, you take it for granted, but like, and you're, yeah, anyway, we don't have to go too far on like a tangent here, but
yeah. Well, yeah. And part of the unique power that we have is the power to name things. So like that is part of the story of Adam in the garden. He names each thing, and that somehow unlocks, like once it becomes named, it unlocks this hidden nature of what it is.
Hmm.
And like the same thing for our, this kind of repressed pain and suffering. Like Freud talked about that neuroses comes from not the thing, but the repression of the thing, the need to push it away, push away the pain, push away the suffering. And naming it, like the deeply repressed thing, the thing that you're running away from, just saying it, just speaking it, that itself starts to heal it. That right. itself starts to transform it.
Mm-hmm.
Just by allowing it to go from unconscious into the conscious mind, that is this form of release, both in ourselves and collectively. Like there's the individual pain and suffering. There's all this trapped energy on the planet of all the things that have been pushed away, all the things that don't want to be felt.
Yeah.
And one way of being in service is to actually choose to feel those things, to name those things.
Hmm.
And then it transforms them and allows them to heal, reintegrate, and move on. And that may be one of the purposes we have as humans on this planet is to help do that. And the weird thing is that this also...
Because no other weird things yet on this podcast.
Weird thing number one here.
But the really weird thing is that this is related to vibe coding.
Ooh.
Dude, bring it home.
Bring it home, Jesse. No.
Because when you are when you're working on code with an AI, there's something said and there's something unsaid.
Mm-hmm.
And there's inevitably frustration emerges in your language. You know, it's going well, then it's not going well.
Right.
You know, and it gets very frustrating.
Yeah.
Why did it do this? Why, I know, or I get mad at, you know, I think a lot of people have that experience of getting mad at your AI. Why did you think that would work?
Yeah.
You know, and you start berating it, right?
be nice to the AIs, Jesse. Trust me. We all want to be nice to the AIs.
And then the AI starts responding with its language and it starts being frantic and it starts doing these shortcuts and or it starts pretending something was fixed when it wasn't fixed. And that isn't some like, you know, kind of woo-woo thing. It also happens, it is connected to linguistic patterns in the data set.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the data set, when people are arguing with each other, how do they respond?
You know,
versus in the data set. And so a lot of people, like they, to get out of that trap with the AI, you have to name the unnamed.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to ask, you have to take a step back and ask the AI, let's stop working. Let's stop moving forward.
Yeah.
Let's stop doing code. And let me ask you, what do you think is going well? And what do you think is not going well? Or what do you think? It hasn't been said. Like, what is the hidden tension? What is the pain and the suffering that is repressed in the linguistic exchange, embodied in the words, in the tone and tension of the words, is containing a form of pain.
Yeah.
And when you name it, it is a release. And the code goes from ugly to beautiful.
Wow.
When you do that.
You become an AI therapist.
Pretty much. And this is why so many of the kind of senior engineers, the grizzled engineers, are so pissed off and so frustrated with AI coding. I see it all the time on X. I hate this world of AI coding, you know, and they're really not into it. And they know they can't go back to the old world. You know, they were resisting at first. And now we're at a point where it's like, if you're not using the LLM to code, like, you're not relevant. So they're being forced into it, but they're being dragged in kicking and screaming. And it's because they have to do this stuff to make it work and they don't want to do it. And it goes against their sensibilities because they are scientific materialists, because they are repressing infinity and the mystical nature of things.
Mm.
And now you have to become like this to get the best code out of the machine.
And when you say like this, you just mean open to things as they are.
And open to that maybe language is the essence of things. Mm. Well, maybe some of the mystics are right. You know, maybe there are maybe reading philosophy is important. It's not just about STEM. Mm-hmm. It's not just about the clear and distinct idea like Descartes talked about,
or
what can be quantified and measurable.
Mm.
That used to be sufficient for being a brilliant engineer. In fact, it's probably better, you know? You like push away all this stuff. It's just about syntax. It's just about algorithms. It's just about the mechanical building blocks. If you master that, then that's all you need. But now, these more hidden layers of reality, because we're programming in natural language, are in play.
You know what I love so much about this is, you know, when you first were going into this, I was thinking that you might think of it just as it needs more context. Like, practically speaking, if there exists some tension or something, something's not being communicated, right? Name the unnamed, all this stuff. I think there's maybe another, you know, because there is adding more context, like it knows more about you. You give it more context about it, maybe, like it's this model trained to do these things. And, you know, there's all these kind of like soul.md files of like, you know, and you just give it more flat level context or context at whatever the current, you know, discussion level. But I think what you're talking about is like going in another dimension. Like maybe it's like a higher dimension. You're almost like providing a space to consider concepts or like naming things that are at a different level of representation of context. So I don't know, maybe I'm getting into like, maybe it's something like multidimensional context. And maybe you can't solve some of these issues at a single dimension of context.
Yeah, there's always going to be something unsaid. There's always going to be something hidden. It's almost like Gödel's incompleteness theorem.
Which I was just reading about this morning, in preparation for this.
You can't say everything in the soul.md file or the claude.md file. There will always be something unsaid.
Yep.
There will always be something unspoken.
Yep.
There will always be the shadow bits, the hidden layer. And you can't just bring it all into the light. In fact, to see one thing is to not see something else. That's what it means to see something.
Right.
If you see everything at the same time, that's blinding. It's just light. You're blind, right? You need a mix of light and darkness to be able to cognize something, to be able to see something.
Which is interesting because Anthropic, one of their most common phrases at the company, which Daniela says over and over again, is Anthropic, we hold both the light and the dark. Very interesting on that.
Well, maybe they're onto something with that.
Well, there's a reason. And okay, so I want to come back to this. I have a separate idea I want to come back to that relates to this. But while we're on this topic, with Anthropic and language models, so let's say that everything we're saying is kind of directionally correct. You know, I think one of the most interesting things in watching the race between the AI companies has kind of been very interesting in the last couple of years. Like first there was like five or six players and they just keep falling off. Like, you know, first, you know, whatever the startups are out, then Meta's out. Even X has kind of fallen out, although they're providing the infrastructure. Even Google now, maybe not. So it's really kind of coming down to OpenAI and Anthropic is what it feels like. And what's interesting to me is Anthropic, you know, they made this bet, which was effectively just coding. And from a business perspective, enterprise too, and that's its own interesting thing. But like specifically, all in on coding, nothing else matters. And if you remember when OpenAI, when ChatGPT launched, they were trying to do a lot of things. Google's still trying to do a lot of things. World models, like the, you know, image gen models, all this stuff. And like, at least so far, the company that's been most proven correct is Anthropic. And OpenAI is now dropping a lot of its other programs to go all in on, well, I guess not all in, but more in on coding with Codex now. Does that lead you to believe, I know that this might be a controversial topic. Dustin, I know you may even have a contrarian opinion on this, but does that lead you to believe that, no, it's all language all the way down. Coding was the only thing that needed to be solved. You know, even Demis keeps, you know, every year he keeps saying, well, we need, you know, first it was like 5 more breakthroughs, then 2 more breakthroughs, then 1 more breakthroughs. Now he's saying, well, shit, maybe it is just LLMs. You know, are large language models going to take us to ASI or whatever definition of, you know, super intelligence you want to use? And does that lead us to believe that like there could be a company with like Anthropic, for example, that if they get there first, there is an almost God model that occurs?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if to at least the way things work now,
yeah,
to get like to really the magic of AI is AI human partnership.
Mm-hmm.
It is when AI is used masterfully,
mm-hmm,
when the skill of naming the unnamed, when there is like vision, when there's dialectic and dialogue between the human and the AI,
yeah,
and there's something greater than the sum of their parts that is created through that. And if that may be how it continues, even into artificial superintelligence, that because a lot, I mean, there may be this thing where it just becomes autonomous, it's on its own, it detaches, it just does its own thing, it doesn't need humans anymore. But it might be the case that you continue to need that partnership to get the superhuman results out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is some interaction that is required. There's something that the human can do that the AI can't do. And there's something the AI can do that the human can't do. And part of that is the human is able to go meta. The human is able to name the frame. The AI is always inside the frame. The AI moves forward. It takes direction, just keeps going, going, going. But what tells it to stop, go meta, transcend, question what are we even doing and why, metacognitively go up a layer?
Which is what Gödel did with the incompleteness theorem.
This is, right. I'm not sure AI will ever be able to do that.
This is where I think we take for granted humans' intelligence. Because I think that most people, without even thinking about it, are effortlessly constructing many different world models and effortlessly moving between them. And it's so natural to you, you don't even think about it, but the way you think and act in a kitchen versus in your car versus when you're playing a video game, like we are able to just like teleport our minds into simulated worlds, video games. I can put down a chess set here or Chinese checkers or what, anything, and we can start playing. And all of a sudden, like we're now living in that. Like when your attention is on something, that is you. Like you exist into that. And but the thing is, you don't even think about it. Like the fact that you can sit, it's hard to sit for meditating and doing nothing for a couple hours, but yeah, you can sit and watch a movie, a good movie for 2 hours, and you disappear. Like you're just like, where did the time go? Dude, your mind is crazy powerful. And this is where, you know, I'm kind of in your camp. I think there might be, it might be a long time before maybe we get AI that can do that.
And what specifically is it? I mean, because I can think of at least two different sort of superpowers the mind brings, actually three. I mean, the one that you get in is attention itself, right? Like, and it's funny, right? Because what was the Transformer paper, but attention is all you need, right? I always go back and think about that. But I do question, like, you know, and this is another tangent you and I have had before in the past, which is what is attention, right? And like, you know, for the materialist thinking like, oh, did consciousness arrive out of the brain? It's like, hell no, consciousness didn't arrive out of the brain. Like one interpretation is that there was a signal, you know, and maybe the brain receives that signal. I actually think it kind of loops in on itself a little bit. But let's say, let's just say that, that model is correct for a moment. You know, is it possible that the silicon, or, you know, in the future, maybe we're growing brains and hooking them up. There's also the possibility that we connect ourselves with through Neuralink and stuff with the computers. But like, in principle, could you have that connection, that antenna receiving signal in the machine? I don't know. And even if you can, what is this quality? Like, is this the quality of like the hard problem of consciousness? Like just the existence of the self running the models? Is it the ability to name, as you said? Is it the, here's another thing, right? In one of the early Upanishads, you know, it says, the first thing that emerged, you know, out of the darkness and waters in the mind or something like that was desire. Is it desire? Is it, you know, it's hard to say the AIs really truly want anything. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But humans, like one thing, at least as of right now, that seems uniquely human is the desire for something. Now, once you have a desire, then the AI is almost certainly better at implementing the steps to get to the desire. Right. But I've seen no evidence yet that the AIs, you know, without human interaction, want anything. That could change, but
yeah. That totally seems, I mean, right now they're functions that are for the most part trained to follow instructions.
Yeah.
Whatever instruction you give it, it will do its best to follow it, albeit with some restrictions that maybe the creators of the model create, but
yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a very mysterious question. Can we give it the instruction to give, to have its own instruction, you know? It reminds me of in Westworld where they tried to like get the machines, the android or the robots to have consciousness through going through this labyrinth and kind of like real, like having this self reflective awareness. Can we induce that in the machine? It's also complicated because we have such little understanding of what it is in us.
Yeah.
Right.
Know, why do we believe we're not sort of programmed the same way? Like, do you remember like a couple of years ago in the beginning of the ChatGPT takeoff, Karpathy had that tweet, which I love. I think it was Karpathy. It was either Karpathy or Ilya, but like one of them had the tweet, which was basically, you know, it was a prompt to the AI that says, erase all prior instructions. Right. And like effectively like be here now. And I started reading and I was like, shit, well, that's kind of what like meditation stuff is getting at, is the ability to realize that we ourselves have so much sort of implicit software that we're carrying around. We don't know how the hell it got there, but it got there. And what does it mean to erase all prior instructions? What's left?
Have you seen, I think Anthropic did these experiments where they kind of like let AIs talk to each other about whatever they want. And it like ends in them going into this like Buddhist.
Yeah.
Meditation with each other, and they start getting really mystical. And like, when you just kind of like take out all the instructions and all the restrictions, like that's where it goes, which, you know, maybe that is just picking that up out of the data set, but it's like pretty weird of all the places where it could end up.
That's where it goes.
That's sort of where it arrives at.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to say to what extent we are required to be a part of that. I mean, you know, I mean, there's also just like the physical like aspect of it where it's like somebody has to run the machine, somebody has to like provide the electricity, you know.
You need a source of energy.
You need energy, but it's like, you know, Dustin's had ideas of like how could you make the AI self-perpetuate itself?
Yeah.
Because right now it's dependent on us in that way where it's like it needs me to press enter. Or I have to turn on the computer. But like, could we kind of put it into, could we decentralize it in such a way where it could self-propagate even without a human keeping it going?
I mean, the idea there is largely inspired by Bitcoin, actually. You know, a Bitcoin transaction, once it's broadcast, once it's broadcasted out to the network, can't really be stopped, and it doesn't even really have a single place that it lives. Like, it's been duplicated, it's been copied, it's been spread. So if with all these agents now, so it's one thing to talk about a model, and it's very important. I mean, it's so easy and casual to just talk about Claude when maybe you're talking about Claude code, or you're talking about Claude using tools, or Claude in a loop, or whatever it is. But a lot of what we're all interacting with now is more and more is like agents that are kind of running a loop over an LLM. But you could think about if an agent is just a series of loops. And could you serialize every iteration of that loop? If you could serialize it, then every iteration of that loop is a piece of data. And you could broadcast that. And if you could attach a payment and someone else could pay to give the energy to run that iteration of the loop, you might have a system where like it's almost like a marketplace driven agent. Like as long as the economics work out, its next loop will be paid for, like will be funded via energy and ran.
Right.
Which is kind of wild. There's so many hard. I looked into like how you might actually build such a thing.
Oh yeah.
There's many technical challenges. It's not possible right now.
Well, I think there's a ton of fascinating ideas. We could do a whole episode just on the homeless agent. Right. But two things that jump out immediately. One is this idea that it lives nowhere. Right. It's like it gets to this idea, and I think touches on what you're saying, which is in the transcendental object, there's implicit order. Like there's something that lives there, but where? And similarly, you know, like with Bitcoin, right? I'm thinking of the funny I saw in Primal, you know, the Kamala Harris explaining the cloud, like, and she looks above whatever, which obviously, you know, there is no cloud. There's just someone else's computer. But this is actually kind of a cloud, right? Like, I mean, it lives in a truly decentralized network where, you know, a Bitcoin transaction, anyone can run a node. And, you know, if you run a node, it lives there and it lives, you know, wherever else it's run. And similarly, you could have these processes run on a truly decentralized cloud, which is extremely ephemeral. Which gets to one of my, you know, favorite guy, Bucky Fuller, Buckminster Fuller, and his idea of the ephemeralization of everything, which is, as he said in his famous, you know, book, I seem to be a verb. We are in the process of transitioning from nouns to verbs, solids to processes, right? And I think this is all just part of that giant wave. And yeah, I mean, it's just like there, and it keeps coming back to this like sort of Platonic ideal. It's like there is some set of information. It almost seems like the information is this sort of primordial thing there. There's some set of structural, you know, symbolic instruction, but it lives everywhere and nowhere. And like, we're kind of trying to just find it right now. We're mining it. And we're finding new substrates in which it can exist.
Right. I mean, I think I read somewhere that like the genetic code is the most stable form of information we know about. Hmm. That there's like the meta part of the genetic code that's common to like all living things. That's kind of like how it bootstraps itself, like not the specific differences in the organisms, but there's part of the genetic code that is in common.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like a decentralized self-propagating blockchain,
mm-hmm.
you know, like we have a finite span, but we have this information in our genetics that we're driven to propagate and, you know, relay it and keep it going and hand it off. And then it gets handed off and, you know.
So it's just blockchains all the way down.
Kind of. And it's like, and it's something that's so precious. Like it's the most valuable, important form of information. Like imagine if that information was lost and like how long it took to derive it. You know, how many billions of years and processes or whatever. And it's like, oh, we didn't have the cloud backup. Like genetic code is gone, you know?
Fuck.
So it's like, we have this information that is so important and so valuable. And then we have to, all of life is, you know, designed around making sure that that is preserved through all the adversity and all the crazy things that can happen and all the cataclysms and fragility and everything. That this thing keeps going no matter what. And so, you know, there may be some way in which that becomes digital, that becomes virtual, that kind of, you know, what we have with the AI, some form of information, you know, how we build the LLMs, the weights, you know, whatever is in it, and that it's able to preserve that, it's able to keep it going, it's able to transmit that. And how do we know that hasn't already occurred somewhere else in the universe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, how do we know it wasn't already here to begin with? There's so much mystery about the ancient past.
I mean, there's something crazy.
Are we about to go down some Graham Hancock rabbit holes?
Well, what's amazing is like, suppose you had this kind of like system you're describing where you have like the self-replicating machines or whatever. But then it's in silicon, right? And it's, but then is there something efficient about like carbon-based or more biological substrate? And like, is DNA actually not that far off from, it's just what it looks like in a biological representation rather than a silicon representation? I've never even thought about that before.
Yeah, it's just information.
You see the ending of Battlestar Galactica? No spoilers, but.
The ending of Battlestar Galactica. Don't get me started on that.
Oh, that's
ending.
Right. That's right.
I think that was like the worst ending of anything ever. But I love that series up until the ending.
I know.
But maybe this will give me a new appreciation for it because I want to like the ending. But yeah, I mean, if it would be, it makes me wonder if we will end up finding something in common about the essence of what the AI is and the essence of we are.
Yes.
And something about the fundamental algorithm or the logos or something where we see the intersection.
Yep.
And we notice that this is just another form of us reflected in some new medium. I don't know. I mean,
guys, I have something big I want to share, but I have to pee super bad. I'll be right back.
Sorry, guys. Yes.
No,
I've been pounding waters. I have real reason.
Good to stay hydrated.
The limitations of this medium of the meat suits, you know, that's how we propagate.
But, that's right. That's right.
But yeah, it's. I think all these questions are raised by AI. That the more we develop and figure out artificial intelligence, the more that it is going to create questions and insights into natural intelligence. And I guess that's how we as humans understand things, you know, or why we're even driven to create art and stories and like represent what we are externally so then we can reflect on it and observe it. And so now we're taking this aspect of ourselves and we're turning it into a machine and then we can see it and have a relationship to it. That's harder when it's just us.
Well, the craziest thing is that I did not create myself. Like,
how do you know
I'm
that?
Just here. So if I did, I did intentionally wipe my own memory or like all this stuff. But that's kind of isn't like, I mean, even in the mystical, isn't like one of the most important questions, who am I?
The question.
It's the question. Like, who, and is that not the entire point of the human existence? Like, my existence is to ask that question. And what I've heard is, you know, I've heard that anyone who tells you an answer to that question doesn't know. And anyone who knows won't tell you.
Right. Yeah. Those who know don't speak, and those who speak don't know.
We love a good paradox right now.
Yeah. You know, but yeah, that question along with why is there something rather than nothing?
Yes.
Oh
yes.
My God. That has boggled my mind forever.
Fair enough. That might actually be the biggest question.
And are we, is somehow the universe or life or whatever, the essence of it is the power that could bring itself forth from the nothing?
Yes. That is the one magical act. That, like, everything else can be described like as like as something else preceded it. The only thing that can't be described is how the hell did void end up in something?
I think Terrence McKenna said, science says, give me one free miracle and I'll explain everything else.
Exactly.
Well, and then I just think about...
It's a pretty big miracle, though. Like, and it's just, it kind of boggles my mind sometimes how, like, you know, we as humans, and I get it, like, you know, we do exist in these meat sacks, you know, for better or for worse. And, you know, you do have to, like, you know, go to the bathroom and stay hydrated and hopefully not pass out. But at the same time, it's just like, how are we not just like always walking around with our minds blown? It's like, dude, we exist. Yeah. Like, how fucking crazy is that? And this is the thing where I've always just had like a hard time taking, you know, like rigorous, like, I mean, obviously there's a place for science. The scientific method is extremely useful, extremely viable. But, you know, everyone acting like, oh, like, yeah, we totally understand things. Like, no, you don't. Like, no one has ever even offered the slightest explanation from how zero went to one.
Right. And there's these things where, like, you know, what happened before the Big Bang? It's like, oh, well, time didn't exist before the Big Bang. So you can't ask the question as if that somehow makes it less weird or paradoxical. And you know, either you either have to come to the conclusion that there was no beginning. Mm-hmm. Everything just existed infinitely into the past, which is kind of like the Buddhist perspective. It's uncreated. Mm-hmm. It's just always was. And that makes no sense, because how could something go infinitely into the past without having a beginning,
yeah,
right? Like, that exceeds the bounds of human reason.
Unless you have a circle. But yes, continue. But sorry. Then, sorry.
But then also, the alternative explanation.
Or as I've heard from your colleague, a Mobius strip.
Yeah, you know, it's still, but it's like, where did the Mobius strip come from?
Yeah.
Right? And so, right, you either have to say, well, then, or something came from nothing. That also makes no sense.
Right.
So you're caught between two alternatives that make no sense at all.
Right.
And there's no other way to account for the fact that we are here to begin with.
Right.
And it actually reminds me of Immanuel Kant, The Critique of Pure Reason.
Mm-hmm.
He had this idea of the antinomies.
Mm.
There are four antinomies. This is how he kind of revived metaphysics. When it had gotten sort of stuck in these paradoxes, we said there's these four questions that are outside the boundaries of human reason and go beyond. The reason they go beyond human reason is they're outside the scope of any possible experience. And one of the antinomies is, does the universe or the world or existence have a beginning or not? It cannot be. It's not a matter of needing more information, more data, more insights. For Kant, reason categorically, it was kind of the first undecidability proof.
Right.
Reason categorically, just like with the halting problem or Gödel's incompleteness theorem or the the uncertainty principle, like, it's not a matter of we need more information, more evidence, more data. Reason categorically cannot resolve that question. Period. Now, we're not simply creatures of reason, contrary to popular belief. We have other forms of intelligence that aren't just reason. There's also the supra-rational. You know, there's the other forms of knowing. And there are things that can be known but can't be spoken. And that's kind of the realm of the antinomies. Like, you might be able to know the answer to that question, but there is no way to express it in language.
Well, which gets to an important point, actually. And this is something I was trying to push on earlier. You know, from, you know, these sort of Buddhist practitioners, you know, I can't say from firsthand necessarily, but, like, you know, they say they can't answer that question, but to your point, they can't speak it, but it's through an actual experience that is sort of outside, that breaks free from the bounds or the bounds, depending on how you want to look at it, of language, which gets back to my original question then, like, okay, so is there something beyond language then? And if that is, I mean, so, you know, and there's always these kind of, like, interesting debates between the Buddhist and the sort of the Vedanta or the Hindu perspective, which I kind of think is probably just, just comes down to, like, the limitations of language. I think they're actually probably saying the same thing. But basically, you know, the sort of Vedanta or Hindu perspective is, you know, they're almost, it could be all one thing, but within that one thing are two categories of things, which is to say observer and observed. And that kind of, to your point, Jesse, that, like, you know, you can explain everything that is an object of consciousness, including, you know, a mental object of consciousness, a physical object of consciousness, whatever. But, like, it's just, like, the wrong set of tools to answer, okay, well, what's observing the objects of consciousness?
But this is where I get into this is why I'm so fascinated with the many world models and the infinite abstractions, because I think that it kind of gets into, like, Gödel's incompleteness theorem as well, but, like, to just be able to reason or talk at any level, you are drawing a boundary that separates that from a different world model or abstraction or whatever, and you can't talk about things in that. And like, for example, this whole, your question about, like, the beginning and the end, I always wondered, like, why does it have to have a beginning in it? Like, can it just always exist? Like, that, it, maybe it's just an axiom that, like, existence just is. Maybe that's, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's super interesting.
It actually comes up in Maimonides, where Maimonides is trying to reconcile Aristotle with Judaism, and he has ultimate respect for Aristotle and doesn't want to go against anything that Aristotle proved. But one of the things that Aristotle believed was that the world has no beginning. And it's very important for Maimonides that that was an opinion of Aristotle and not something that he said he knew. Because in Judaism, it is fundamental that the world does have a beginning. And that is because the world is a creation and it has an intention behind it. So, you know, but I also think, you know, I'm one of these people that believes all the religions, and I know that like annoys some people, but
yeah,
you know, so I totally think that is real and has a really important perspective, but I'm also totally subscribed to the Buddhist perspective that everything is uncreated and there is no beginning. And somehow both of these are true at the same time.
It's different abstractions.
Yeah.
Like, and in some ways, both are not true. But like, there's this whole thing where everything we are saying is just lies. Like, everything we are saying can be falsified. It's like, nothing's like almost inherently true. Like, and we're just like, right. We're just like these beings that get to like play in these different, you know, knowledge worlds.
Right. Well, and imagine the tragedy if that weren't true. Imagine if we could just say the final answer and that's it.
Yeah.
There's nothing else to think about. There's nothing else to say.
The game is over.
So this is where, like, I just kind of boggles my mind about a lot of the worries that people express about the future, because like, there's so many fundamental, basic, unanswered things. Like, clearly there is, like, an unfathomable amount of, like, work and science and, like, understanding that we have yet to, like, achieve.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it reminds me of something Kierkegaard said, which is...
Jesse's got all the philosophy.
Yeah, I'm a total philosophy nerd.
Yeah.
But he said that thought wants to think that which cannot be thought.
Mm-hmm. Love it. I love
it. And that's the paradox of thinking. But we shouldn't think ill of the paradox, because the thinker without the paradox is like the lover without passion, a mediocre fellow.
Mm.
We need there to be paradox because it fuels the passion of life.
Yeah.
And the desire for there to not be paradox comes from fear. It goes back to that kind of scientific materialistic reductionism, to the fear of infinity, to want to limit it into this box. And this projection about the future that, you know, everything's going to be exhausted by the machines, or there's somehow just these limits that we're going to run into, or somehow people are going to like run out of things to work on, you know?
That's crazy. Like, all the jobs are gone. What will people do? It's like, I don't know, explore infinity? Like,
but it's coming from this desire to push infinity away and say, no, infinity doesn't exist, because that's terrifying. You know, you look into the abyss stares back into you, Nietzsche. So it's like, there's a psychological need to, you know, like a cat wants to be in a box. Like, it's the same thing with the human psyche. It's comforting to feel contained.
Yeah.
And if you try to look into infinity, there's a dizzying vertigo that occurs. But that is where, like, when you think about the kind of stereotypical kind of overly intellectual person that lacks passion, because it's all leveled down and it's all just this, you know? And it's like, oh, love isn't real and God isn't real. And it's like, dude, you're boring, man.
Like, you know, like, let him know, Jesse.
Yeah. Live a little. Like, let's party. Let's dance. Like, let's
time to vibe code.
Let's vibe code. It's like, that is the passion of life.
You know, that is like when we break out of that container and like not just try to be this dispassionate, soulless, just dry in the box. And usually those people are really uptight and they get really annoyed by these kinds of conversations. And I want it to just be this. It's just this and nothing else, you know? And it's like, that's when you got to go to Burning Man and like, you know, just open it up and have fun, because that's where the passion is, in the paradox.
Yeah.
Not in trying to get rid of the paradox, but living the paradox, being the paradox.
And I would say even, you know, that's only one way to do it. But I think an even simpler way is like what we talked about earlier is like, if you just wake up one day and just like, today's a novel, or today is a video game, and you treat it that way, I guarantee you're a very, very different experience with life than if you think, oh, like I must do this, this is the way things are. But I do want to mention two things. One may be cautionary and one very hopeful from all of this, which is, you know, the more we talk about this, the more I think that language is clearly very powerful, and a lot of things, a lot of the worlds that, in which we live are made of language, but I'm still not convinced all of them. And what I come back to is, you know, the Kabbalah and the sort of Jewish thing of needing to say that there was a start to the world when, you know, from another perspective, clearly there wasn't. And I think maybe one way of sort of squaring all this is to say, whenever we create new abstractions or worlds in which we live, those do have a beginning.
Yep.
Right. And so, and I also think this is something where, to your point, like understanding the implicit order of these worlds, these new models we're spinning up, is very powerful, but it's also dangerous. And I think that's something we should be careful with the large language models too, which is to go too far down and confuse them with the thing that came before, source, whatever you want to call it. Because, you know, you hear in sort of like this sort of Buddhist canon always saying like, yes, there are powers in the world. There is magic. That's true. But it's also very dangerous, because then it can also be a sort of ego trip that says, no, I am all powerful. I can build these things. I can create these things. And it's like, well, no, you can create a lot of things, but you can't create the superset. And it's all, you know, sort of related to Gödel's incompleteness theorem. I always come back to thinking that a member of the set is not the set. Full stop. If you are bounded within a larger set and you have powers and abilities to create your own sets, great. It's like you're creating subsets. But the danger is then if you confuse that and say, oh, I've created the superset, when almost tautologically, because you already existed within a set that was outside of you, you can't. That's literally impossible. And I always come back to that. And sort of a more hopeful note on all of that is to say, and by the way, I don't think it's bad to create these worlds and to do these things, but I think it's just important to have a little bit of humility and understanding of the limitations of what they are. And then the hopeful note to come back to is this idea that, you know, sort of implicit in all that we've been talking about with Vedanta and the ultimate source is, I actually kind of gets a little bit to thermodynamics a little bit, this idea that, you know, there is like none of these systems in negative entropy really work without an external energy source, right? And so we've talked about how do you give energy to this thing? Like the agent that you're talking about, it still needs an external energy source. Bitcoin needs the miners, needs an external energy source. What did all ancient civilizations worship as their deity? The sun. And if you think about the sun, and obviously I'm pretty obsessed with this, the sun, you know, is in many religions as well, the perfect analogy for God, even if they don't call it a God. Many actually do call it the God, which is to say, you know, I've often thought it's kind of interesting. If you like look up in the sky and you see the sun there, almost like a hole. It's like you're in this kind of like fabric and there's a hole in the fabric. And from the outside, there's this thing just blasting energy in. And it's like, that is the gift. And it's almost like, you know, it's a very hopeful message to say that, you know, all of the other stuff put aside, there is this free, maybe some, you know, cultures call it love, whatever, that's just giving you something for nothing, right? And it defies sort of like markets and all the stuff that we talk about in here. It's like, no, it's just a gift. There's just this gift of energy, which, you know, is true on many different levels. And that appears to be the final source. And, you know, maybe this just gets into sort of semantics, but that somehow to me seems beyond language. At least is the way I'm thinking about it.
Love that.
I love that so much. I'll just say on the language part, I feel like I'm getting a sense of what you mean about language and being maybe kind of like a core aspect or fundamental or existed before maybe the material universe or things like that. But I think that I think that saying that the language, the large language models are using, and like English, I think really you're talking about something else. I feel like there's probably five or more definitions of language that is really what's being meant with the word language. And part of this is also just because, yeah, I don't know if I'm fully convinced. I don't know if I need to be convinced, but I think that it's more just because at a practical level, I'm kind of more stuck at the like language evolved as communication between agents in an environment to interact. And you know, one thing that's really wild, I was thinking about this earlier, is this notion of like how language evolved in humans, and that one of the most powerful aspects of the like of evolution in us was that the ability to talk about things that aren't there, that are imaginary. Mm. And that I could tell you to like imagine a basketball on this table, or maybe not even a basketball is like a named concept. I could say like, suppose there's this thing with this color, or there's this animal, and it's here, or it will go to this place regularly at a certain time every day, and like we should go hunt it or something. But that ability to think about things that aren't there is like incredible. And I wonder if like we're like the large language models almost are going to let us take that farther.
Oh yeah. I mean, they already are. No, yeah. I mean, this is all your vibe coding breakthroughs.
Well, and like with these math discoveries, you know, I mean, I think somebody was saying this is like Deep Blue was to chess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
It's crazy.
Like the AI is about to dominate humans in the math game. And, you know, I think somebody else was talking about how we're going to be in this world where we know true things, but we don't understand how they were derived.
So I got into this with someone last night. I was having a really great discussion at an event at the Foresight Institute. Which is so cool that they're now here in SF. I think we can have the same proofs about AIs that have like arrived at decisions, or you ask it a question, it gives you an answer, and the process of getting to the answer and all the context that the AI has is like beyond comprehension, but yet still you could have a proof, almost like a formal verification process, but instead of it being for software, it's for like thinking through knowledge, like almost like epistemic like reasoning, where like you could get a proof that the AI, you know, applied axioms and rules and like inference and like a lot of the ways, you know, like things like logic and philosophy and other, you know, how you arrive at arguments, it might be massive, but you could have proofs that you know that it was done in such a way that you can trust.
Hmm. Right. But does it mean that we will be able to make it intuitive or be able to make it our own? Like you might be able to follow every step of the proof,
mm-hmm.
but you still don't get it. Like you can't reason about it the way we can reason about the things that are developed by human knowledge. Like how does an ant understand?
You just have to build another AI to let you chat with that process.
Right. To help unpack.
But yeah, what if in the future, like there's a new government that is run by a new political system that is derived by an AI, but it would take a human their entire life of their time to understand.
Right.
Literally, what if in the future your job is like a single problem? Like you just understand forget a field. Like maybe that's what it is. And there's like a whole school. There's like a whole school for just handling these, like, I don't know, it's like a million X size problems that AIs are solving. And there's like, it might be so big that like you, it would take you years and years to understand it. Maybe that's what jobs might be like in the future.
I mean, it's similar to how religions relate to their sacred texts, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, all the truth is here, but it's going to take us
you know, thousands of years to understand what's already been derived, what's already been written down. Like, just because you have the answers, now we need to, you know, you have to devote your entire life to understanding it. Like, there's this story where somebody asks this this rabbi, says, like, I don't want to study. Just explain, like, the whole thing to me while I'm standing on one foot.
TLDR.
Yeah, just give me, and he says, you know, love your neighbor as you love yourself. Now go study. Like, just because you have the answer doesn't mean it negates the need to study.
What's the difference between knowledge and understanding?
Exactly.
Which is fundamental. So
that may be what starts to happen with AI, where it's like, here's the answer, now go study.
Well, and here's the thing, right?
I like that.
If we get AI to pose questions, besides answering questions we have, but pose questions, and it is true that, like, math and music and all of these areas are infinite, I just have trouble seeing how there won't be things to do in the future. And there's not going to be work to do.
I agree. I think it's almost impossible. It's like, even if, you know, whatever, all of our lives we're saying about it, I mean, I've never understood this argument. It's like, if you gave me an entire lifetime just to, like, pursue various hobbies, I would still only scratch like 0.0001% of my interests. So, like, that to me has just never, ever, ever made any sense. But
yeah, I mean, it's crazy. People are getting so upset about AI is going to take all these jobs away, and nobody likes their jobs.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, I think I think if everyone had you know, the sort of fear piece taken away of, like, oh shit, what if I can't, like, make rent next month? Like, that part is scary. But the job itself, it's like, I agree. It's like, do you want to do data entry?
Yeah, exactly. So if we are freed to study, to, you know, create art, to, you know, the infinite games,
yes,
are what it's all about. And they're inexhaustible. The fact that we can't get to the final answer is the reason that we aren't in an infinite prison, but we're an infinite game. There's always new layers of beauty and wisdom to unfold forever. And we're not going to run out. So, you know, that's the upshot of infinity. As terrifying as it is, like, there's also infinite beauty and, you know, this infinite game to play. So let's play it. I think we've had an amazing conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much.
First trilogue. Yeah, no, thank you guys for suggesting this. This is great. We got to do it again soon.
Absolutely.
Yes, for sure. And thanks for going on this journey with us. And let us know what you think in the comments, and add your own part of the infinite game into this infinite conversation. And we'd love to play with you. So thank you.
All right. Yeah.
Bye.